This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Where does my mind go? What replaces me? TikTok.
The great minds, Newton, Einstein, Nietzsche, Asimov, they all needed isolation and deep thought for the breakthroughs that define modern civilization. When everyone is connected to endless outside stimulation, where will new creation come from? Are short posts and videos served up by algorithms dumbing us down? Maybe machines are not becoming more like us. They train us to become more like them. Are we building idiocracy? Our next guest calls it TikTokification. He is an accomplished scientist recognized in his entirely different field. He prefers to remain anonymous at this point. I have looked into his expertise, and it is mind-boggling. Though safely out of America, for this discussion we use his net name when posting on Medium, which is The White Orange. From somewhere out there, Mr. White Orange, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex.
How would you introduce us to the phenomenon of TikTokification?
What I call TikTokification is really the reshaping of all our media, not just what we see on TikTok, into more of a TikTok-style format. So this goes from the news, from other social medias, even we may argue the books, becoming more like TikTok. And this is like a twofold aspect to it, I would say. So on the one hand, we can see across the world things becoming shorter. So this is happening to books. You may also have experienced it with the news, or you know, some news nowadays are just like a simple headline even to YouTube. And then the other clear symptom of this phenomenon is what we have seen on Instagram, YouTube, is where all sorts of content is becoming these vertically scrollable videos that are so characteristic of TikTok. But because TikTok is the leading platform in terms of grabbing attention, all other platforms have had to adapt and adopt the same type of content. So what this is creating is that it's not just the content on TikTok that is becoming short and shallow, but also every other platform out there, every other form of media is becoming shorter and shallower as a result of this dominance of TikTok format.
All right. If I go out for a walk, not a lot happens. I don't expect any car accidents or a come on from sexy people. It is slow time. And back in the chair and looking at the screen, I open TikTok and right away, there's more excitement in minutes than half a lifetime in slow world. Real life is just boring compared to continuous blasts of compressed attention. But why should we be bored some of the time?
Right. So I think that's an interesting point. And I would already challenge that, you know, life is boring depending on your scale, right? I mean, maybe a heroin addict will not find real life stimulating either. The same way someone that is, you know, a heavy user of TikTok might not find going for a walk that's rewarding or stimulating, right? So I think it really depends on the scale, on what you're used to. So yeah, it's just boredom gives us this time and space for the brain to self-introspect and think about our place in life and, you know, whether we are content with what we're doing or whether we need to rethink or, you know, our current life. And if our brain is constantly, you know, if the attention is constantly put onto something, this could be even, you know, if you can think of this thought experiment, right, where someone has all of his or her working hours fixed on a movie, then the person will be incapable of generating new ideas or reflecting whether what they're doing with their time is worth. So boredom really gives us this space and time for the brain to introspect, to digest what we've gone through, you know, be it during the day or during our life, and basically give us the motivation to do the boring stuff, which is oftentimes the most rewarding stuff, right, which is maybe pursuing that degree or starting to learn a new language. If we are constantly entertained, we will never have the ambition or the motivation to go for these harder purposes in life, which I would argue is what ultimately brings joy, right? This type of goals that require certain effort over a prolonged period of time, but in the long run, it's what gives us satisfaction in our life.
These days, people work in warehouses, listening to podcasts. Young people have phones out all the time, interacting with friends over the phone and those right there at the table. Is it possible older people did not learn to multitask and young people did?
That's an interesting question. And I'm not a neuroscientist, so take this with a grain of salt. But I can conceive that probably young people are somewhat better adapted at maybe what we would call multitasking. But I think it's very clear, if you look at the research, that we are most productive and most attentive, and even we drive more enjoyment and we learn better when we are concentrated with the task at hand. So I think multitasking is almost like a myth. We are better at doing single things and focusing deeply on them. And when we do that, it's when we get the most out of those tasks. So I think in general, the term multitasking is overblown, or it's not really an effective way of doing the type of things that require concentration and attention. So that, I can conceive that there might have an edge over old people, but I don't think there's such a thing as multitasking.
It's interesting you should say that, because I'm an old computer guy, and even when the first chips came out that claimed to multitask, in fact, they weren't. They were just moving from one task to the other very rapidly, but they could never do it all at the same time. All right. That's now, true. I'm thinking about people who are skimming through social media. Perhaps it makes our minds more shallow. And then does that add up to a more shallow culture? Maybe we've reached peak ideas and we're getting ready to stall out, or an even darker thought, maybe a few people will generate new knowledge or art, but there isn't much public left with enough focused mind to receive it. Your thoughts?
Actually, coming back to this cheap idea that you mentioned, I think that's also very interesting, because in truth, that's what we may call multitasking even in humans, right? With swapping, I devote 30 seconds in one task and I devote 30 seconds in another one. And another thing that research is very clear on is that the moment we swap between one task to another one, there is something that they call, I think, residual attention, which is that your mind takes a while to completely switch, from whatever you were thinking to the next task. So even if we conceive multitasking as this quick swapping between tasks, then it's very clear that that's not an efficient way to work. If we agree that there is a... And that's the argument I make on what I wrote on Medium is that there is the vast majority of people nowadays are just devoting their attention to this, mindless scrolling. So the flip side of that is that, well, if you're a person that is capable of focusing deeply on a task at hand for long hours every day, it's very likely that you're going to succeed. So in other words, if this skill has become so rare that perhaps we're on a time that it's easier than ever to succeed, right? You just need to be able to focus, and that already is something, whereas maybe 100 years ago, that was a commonplace. The other thing, of course, is that, as I mentioned in the post as well, is that obviously, if you're writing, obviously when you create anything, be it a book or maybe a song, well, ideally you wouldn't need to think of an audience, right? People should do these things because they love them and because it gives them an intrinsic reward. But unfortunately, more and more nowadays, people, when creating something, have the audience as the goal. So that means that obviously you have to sacrifice maybe quality or refinement or complexity just to adapt your message to this more shallow audience. So for sure, I think the content is being reshaped by the audience. And therefore, that also affects creators, right? They need to think, okay, how am I going to deliver my message so that people can understand it? And that inevitably means dumbing it down. And then in terms of whether we've reached peak ideas, it's for sure reversible. But I think it's very worrying that we're letting these AI algorithms reign loose. And we may find ourselves, in terms of whether we've reached our peak intellect, right, as a civilization, the good news is that obviously, there's nothing permanent about what's going on. I do think that we are downtrending in a way. We're becoming more and more dumb. And I think anyone that has spent any amount of time on the internet can testify for this. As I was mentioning earlier, you read the news or you need, even what qualifies as news today. This can be like Elon Musk tweeting whatever nonsense that has happened through his brain. How is that relevant? How is that part of the news, right? So even the type of content that is relevant nowadays is clearly less important or, you know, more nonsensical than 50 years ago. But the good news is that there is nothing permanent, right? As we know, the human brain hasn't changed. It's just being wired to this new technology. And obviously, if we were to regulate these things or put the brakes on these AI algorithms, you know, drawing our attention, then we could easily revert back to a more, what I hope to be a more refined society and one that values deep thought and creative ideas as we used to do 100 years ago or 50 years ago.
Neither of us are psychologists or brain experts, but we can wonder what happens to our minds when scrolling through close-ups of birds or newly seen galaxies trillions of miles away or all the things that appear. Are we conscious? Do we learn anything? Does this change the way our brains are wired? What do you think about that?
Right, so I think for sure it changes the way our brains are wired, and in any specialty or any job, like be it, I don't know, I spend a lot of time on my computer, so I'm certain my brain is wired to the keyboard in a way, right? So the keyboard has almost become part of, it's like an addition to, an extension of my body, right? And this goes to, you know, be it painters or maybe a musician, a highly accomplished musician that has been playing, let's say, the trumpet for 10 years. That trumpet is almost like an extension of his brain or his body. And it is, you know, it's what research told us. So really the brain will adapt to whatever it is that you're doing consistently, right? So it is for sure true to say that the social media rewires the brain, but in the same way that if you read, you know, 3 hours a day, your brain will be rewired in a different way, right? Now, how does it rewire it, or what happens when we scroll through, you know, as you said, this random assortment of events or videos? So I think, you know, we're almost completely switching off, right? We're just taking in this content without thinking for a second about what it is that we are watching. And then I think what is very important to reflect upon for anyone using these things is, you know, how do you feel afterwards, right? So for instance, when, you know, even if you're reading may seem like a hard for some people, you know, it requires you to obviously concentrate and switch off from anything else. How you feel afterwards, you probably feel very calm, right, after reading for 30 minutes or even watching a movie for 2 hours or any other thing where you put your attention to a single thing for a continuous amount of time. The period afterwards, it's very likely that you will feel very relaxed. But the way one feels after having your brain spin through these 30-second bits of nonsense, it's really not that way, right? You will feel agitated, you will feel more nervous, it's like you will feel stressed, and you haven't really given your brain the rest that we were talking about earlier, right, to self-introspect and to be in a more calm state. What is going on really is that you're taking your brain for a dopamine rush. It's becoming more agitated, more stressed. And as a result of that, afterwards, you will not only feel drained and more stressed, but also you will feel like, as we were discussing earlier, that any other task or going for a walk or any of these tasks that normally would be somewhat pleasurable or perhaps not the most stimulating but at least bearable will feel like the most extremely task at hand, right? So, and I guess in more scientific terms, what is happening is that you're giving your brain this dopamine rush. And the way the brain reacts to that is that it will, or your dopamine receptors will become either less sensitive or you will have less of them to counteract these sudden bursts of dopamine. If you do that over and over every day, at the end of the day, you will rewire your brain to need this overstimulation to feel, or in the same way that a caffeine addict will need a higher dose to feel anything.
I'm interested in what you're talking about here, because if personalized stimulation like TikTok is a drug, if it operates like a drug, and same for scrolling and Twitter, I wonder, does the user require bigger and bigger hits to get the same high? I mean, people do crazy things to get viral hits on YouTube, for example. Some of them are dangerous things to do. Could TikTok fever be a factor that fuels more extreme behaviors in social media and then real life? I mean, perhaps TikTok is shaping extremism, and that could explain a lot of what we're seeing in society and politics today.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, it feels that you need to always take the bar higher, right, in terms of whatever dumb it is that you want to do, especially if you don't have any talent, right? You know, there are all these crazy trends and all this sort of weird behavior that people will engage in just to drive attention. I mean, it is related, but it's not solely the fault of TikTok, I would argue. It's also the fact that we have so much information that it is not enough to just produce high-quality content or something that can be really interesting for the audience. You need to somehow get that speaker out and be like, hey, I'm here. And the way to do that, unfortunately, it's becoming more and more doing this extreme nonsensical behavior.
And you say that some of the content is actually void, it's empty, it's contentless. Could you talk to us about that?
I think, or very generally, you can divide the content you see on, you know, the type of platforms that where the algorithm chooses what you watch, right? Be it TikTok or Instagram. And if people will try to either provide some piece of information, so something that is curiosity, you know, and the usual, why do we XX do this, right? The usual title to grab your attention. And then they will resolve that question, right? They will give you that information. Or it could be even a tutorial, right? How do I take care of the plants in my garden? And there will be a YouTube tutorial for that. At the other end, if you will, we have humor, right? We will have something that is funny. Someone making a joke or some kittens or some stuff like that. But I think it's very interesting nowadays because the content on TikTok is so shallow. There is almost this third category of content that I call a contentless, which is basically content that is nor funny nor informative in any way. It just can be things like, I don't know, people dressing up in some... It's hard to convey this on the phone, but I hope people get a feel of what I'm talking about if they've spent, you know, some time on Instagram or in TikTok. But it's usually this type of content that will leave you very void. It will not make you laugh. It will not give you any information. It's purely devoid of any real content.
And people are scrolling, and some are doom scrolling, and they know that time is more than wasted. Some people feel bad about giving up their time in life. They call it brain rot, and yet they still go back. I wonder, is this more like a pornography for the brain?
You could call it pornography. Why not? Although I'm not here to defend pornography, but I would argue pornography has its place. So I would call it junk food for the brain. But in the same way, you could argue that junk food has its place, you know, hopefully small. But yeah, and I think what you're describing is it is almost the regret someone feels when they develop an unhealthy relationship with drugs, right? Which is this routine where, okay, they would start to have regret feelings and start to ponder, okay, maybe I should quit this, I shouldn't use it, it's bad for me. And then maybe they, you know, they go 2 days without, you know, trying whatever it is they're addicted to. And then the third day they fall again, right? And they feel bad about themselves. Then they don't enjoy it anymore. So the type of vocabulary that people use is a clear reflection of the unhealthy relationship they've developed with these algorithms. And what it's telling us is that the mechanisms by which operates are no different than that we associate with drugs.
And what we thought life was about seems to be disintegrating. Maybe a lot of people find wrenching changes all the time, everywhere. Too much to face. I know that the last week or two in the United States has been just a tidal wave of strange changes. So people become content to lease out their minds to the media, as millions of people did with TV. What is wrong with that? And is it different this time?
I would say the first problem with that is that people are not really facing, you know, whatever is going on in their environment, but rather escaping from it. And if that worries you, right, you should either, you know, maybe rethink your life or try to do your little action to help. And if you feel things are changing too fast, which they are and they will, you know, maybe it's time to, you know, step up your whatever, your, you know, try to learn what is going on in the world, you know, try to educate yourself. And I think if we turn to TV or social media, and I will now discuss, you know, what I think is different from those two. We're really switching off, right? We're really stopping to think and stopping to think critically. And I think what is really important is that we step up, right? If we think things are unfair out there, or, you know, or things, or we don't like things around us, then I think switching off is not really the solution. And the problem with TV or with social media is that too often this becomes our escape, right? We just turn to these things, we switch off our brains, and then we are seemingly happy, but in reality we've just switched off. And then, you know, you could argue that it also, again, it's about facing these situations and knowing how to cope with them instead of escaping them. And I think what's different from TV to social media, although there are many similarities, right, in the sense that people don't really choose their content, although on TV, I guess, if there is a recurrent program, you may be like, okay, well, on Tuesdays at 10 p.m., there's this program that I like. And I think that's very legitimate use of TV. But the problem with social media is that, as opposed to TV, where you would presumably allocate some time a day to watch it, so let's say, you know, you go to work, you go back home, you're really tired, you cook dinner, and then you're like, well, now I'm going to have my 2 hours of TV, right? And you focus on that, and you switch off anything else. The problem with social media is twofold. Is that first, it will infiltrate in every aspect of our life because we carry it with us, right? We carry our phones with us. And the problem is not so much. I think a very legitimate use of social media would be like if you say, well, every day I'm going to devote 30 minutes uninterrupted on my phone on social media, right? Scrolling to social media. And I think that's a very legitimate use. But the problem is that because of how they are designed, they will slowly infiltrate in your life and you will revert to scrolling on social media at the slightest feel of discomfort, right? And this could be queuing on a shop. This could be maybe in your classroom, you're feeling bored and just, you know, pop up your phone and start scrolling. So the key difference is how it will infiltrate in every aspect of your life and how, as a result, it will hamper your attention in the long run, right? You will rewire your brain to add the slightest discomfort or you know, when I say discomfort, it could be something that is boring. It could be a task that is challenging. But we can also argue it could be like, oh, my God, I read that, I don't know, this X thing happened in the news. And then because I cannot cope with it, I'm going to just doom scroll and watch kittens on the internet instead just to be at peace, right? So I think that's the difference between TV and social media. It is the fact that we just carry it with it and it's designed to interrupt our attention as opposed to TV where you would still make use of your attention in a way.
So when you wrote these posts on Medium, TikTokification, you looked around for possible signs that would back up your case that these super rapid stimulants may be damaging brains, at least in the short term, and the ability to think by the public. And one of the things that you looked at was a comparison to attention deficit disorder. Do you want to talk about that?
There is this book by Nicholas Carr. It's called The Shallows. And I think it's the first person that draw to my attention this problem, right? And he describes how, obviously, he's a journalist, he's a writer, so, you know, we can think that he's a person that needs to sit for long hours and think deeply about what he writes. And he was describing this situation where he felt how his brain has changed, right? How he can no longer sit down and switch off, and his brain will become fidgety, as he describes it. And the symptoms that he describes are very much like those of ADHD, right? Is this difficulty concentrating, feeling restless, forgetting about, you know, things. And when you read that, you know, I could be describing myself. I could be describing myself when, you know, I try to write this post. And I'm sure anyone that has tried to do anything that requires some level of concentration, especially if it's outside work, right? If it's on your free time where it's, you know, you don't have any motivation to do that. I think anyone can relate to these symptoms. And then when you look at the data, it's very clear that ADHD is on the rise. Like anywhere you look, the rates are increasing and it's strikingly clear. Again, I'm not a neuroscientist. And so, yeah, I'm aware that the way ADHD has been diagnosed has changed over time. But I think it's such a loose definition, right? Because it's not like, I don't know, let's say something more objective, okay? Like a brain tumor, right? Where we can do a scan of your brain and determine, like, okay, this person actually has a brain tumor and this person does not. ADHD is a very loosely defined condition. And although there's absolutely some people that will be genetically different, right? They will have their brain will be wired differently. And as a result, they will have problems focusing and so on. But I dare to say that behind these increased rates of ADHD is social media.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Please, please support your local radio station with a good donation.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Mr. White Orange, scientist and author of the TikTokification series on Medium. You looked into this somewhat, and you found that this 140-character limit, as we had on Twitter and the TikTok culture, seems to have affected long-form media as well, like books and science papers and even reading trends. Could you tell us some of what you found?
As I said earlier, right, we are somewhat touched upon this, that because the content that we are being served is becoming shorter and shorter, and people are finding it harder to focus, as a result, the public demands shorter content, right? They cannot, no one is, or obviously I'm exaggerating, right? But let's say no one is any more capable of reading, you know, a 400-page book or whatever. So as a result, if you're a creator, you need to think, okay, how do I deliver my message to this new audience, right? This new audience that cannot cope with such a long books. You know, wherever you look at, if you look at books, if you look at papers, if you look at music as well, everything is becoming shorter, anything you look at. And there are these, you know, very scary reading trends. You know, when you look at the UK, the US, Japan, all these countries have seen decline in reading times. So it's very clear that we are reading less. And not only that, but also the content we're being served, especially that is harder to simulate, like books, is becoming shorter.
I know from talking to publishers that if I were to submit a 700-page work, as some of our great pieces of literature are, it would be rejected immediately. They're looking for now not even 400 pages, but perhaps 200 pages with a lot of points and short little bits. So I know that that has changed. Now, Canadian Marshall McLuhan warned in the 1960s that the medium is the message. And I think that's really worth thinking about with these new social media. The printing press revolutionized knowledge and society, but maybe social media is just part of an evolution and we haven't seen it yet and older people feel left out. I think we have to leave room for younger people who are using these social media to make their own case.
First of all, I would argue I'm a social media user, right? And the way I've come to see that they see it now is through using it and through reading about it, right? And about all the dangers it entails and how, I guess, it affects myself, but also how I see that it affects other people. And in fact, if I may go on a tangent slightly, it almost frightens to me more. You know, we tend to put a lot of focus on the younger generation, you know, whatever. I think there is now like an Instagram Kids and YouTube Kids, right? We tend to, or there's a lot of emphasis on protecting children. But what worries me as well is that, you know, if you have like my parents, which are, you know, relatively old, they are completely vulnerable, right? My generation, which I'm around 30, by the way, I think we are very aware of all the dangers social media may create, and we can talk about it, whether it's dangerous or not, in a second. But the elder generation, and I'm talking about, you know, 70 plus, are not aware at all of how social media might rewire your brain. How does the algorithm work? What is the algorithm learning? Is it learning your behavior? Is it learning your thought pattern? You know, so they are completely vulnerable about this new technology, and yet they might use it, right? And I think it's not possibly everyone knows in our inner circle an elder person that is addicted to social media. You know, you would send him or her a message and they would reply immediately, and you can tell they are constantly on it because they have no, or they are not conscious about what it is that they are using and whether it is even addictive. Because, you know, you can create an account. I always bring this example, which is when you walk into a casino, there will always be signs somewhere saying that, okay, gambling is addictive, you know, and you need to be over 18. Like, it's very clear that you're entering a place that could be dangerous, right? If used sporadically, it's perfectly fine thing to do, but it has the potential to be dangerous. But when you create your account on social media, there is no banner saying, hey, hold on a second, just so you know, this thing can be addictive. I just wanted to make the point as well that we tend to think about younger generations, but we never think about elder generations, which haven't really caught up with this technology, yet they may be using it as if it was harmless. And then coming back to your point as to whether, you know, maybe I'm older and I don't understand TikTok or, you know, or whatever it be. I'm a user of it, and I think I understand the way it impacts my life, so to speak.
I'm just picturing how people who really love TikTok and love Facebook and all the YouTubes, how they would react to our discussion. I mean, would they say, oh, you just don't understand, and we do.
Yeah, it can absolutely happen. But I think we must not forget that the ultimate goal of these tools is to hook you on the screen for as long as possible. And I guess the difference was that at least the TV was broadcast to the average citizen, right? You could not really tailor a TV for you, Alex, right? Or a TV for me, you know, tailored specific to my taste, whatever it is that I like. The problem now is that this is driven by an algorithm that is learning not only about what you like, but also how you use the app, you know, how long you spend on it. And God knows, they may even be gathering data about, you know, whatever it is that your purchases and, you know, other internet sites that you visit. So I think just from that point of view, knowing that you're being monitored by an algorithm whose sole purpose is to hook you on the screen for as long as possible, I think it's hard to make a benign case for social media. But what I can conceive is that there's certainly like a legitimate use, and obviously in small doses may not be detrimental. The same way that, you know, if you gamble with your friends, I don't know, once in a month, it might be a perfectly fine thing to do, and, you know, it can be a fun thing to do. But I think the problem is that it is designed to interrupt your life, right? To mess up with your brain and to interrupt your attention wherever it is that you're going and whatever it is that you're doing. So I don't know, maybe they will listen to us and think that we are just two old grumpy people talking about technology they don't understand. But I don't know, you tell me.
Well, I want to go into a bit of a complex thought that I have about this. And I look back at classic education as it was taught in the 1900s. After learning basic tools like mathematics and reading, students were required to build up layer after layer of knowledge. There were structures, and there were institutes of medicine and geology to maintain those structures. And the computer, on the other hand, as a machine, it disassembles everything into numbers and then patterns of those numbers. And I think that the bits of the computer, or whatever you want to call them, they can be like Lego bricks, and they've got built-in connectors, I suppose. And then the computer reassembles those small pieces, but it can present them in a million ways, some outside the frameworks accepted by humans. So I think artificial intelligence and algorithms are leading humans to compute in that same way, where all the little pieces can stand by themselves, but they can fall together in new ways, and that stimulates our brain. And I call this process shredding and then chaotic assembly. Does that make any sense to you for what we're talking about?
Right. So you're saying, is it, if I understood your thoughts, is it that machines are making us think more like a machine? Is that you, what you were trying to describe there?
Yes, I think that is what's happening.
Right. So if I may add to that. So it is certainly true. And maybe coming back to this idea of the medium is the message. I think there is a quote also in The Shallows. He's quoting Nietzsche, or I can't remember who it was, that he felt that the moment he transitioned from pen and paper to the early typing machines, he felt his thoughts became more mechanical. So I guess there could be a point to be made that, you know, whatever tool it is that you're using to create, or even one may argue to consume or information, will inevitably shape that information, right? And the way we perceive it. And I guess maybe if I may add as well, is that now more than ever, all the information is being dictated by algorithms, right? One may even argue that it is algorithms that choose what's important and what's not important, right? Why is a certain piece of information a headline and not another one? And in many respects, many of the information we consume is just being bound by algorithms, right? And maybe if I may give a recent example, right? When this deepfake came out, I think it was last week or two weeks ago, the headline I was seeing everywhere on the internet was this DeepSeek from China, and oh, the U.S. is losing, you know, the AI battle, or what it means for the U.S. So basically, you know, you could conceive this piece of information as being solely about China. You could frame it like, okay, China has developed this great AI, period. But all the headlines for some reason, had this comparison to the U.S., right? There was some implication to the U.S. So it felt almost as orchestrated, right? As if these algorithms had, I don't know, maybe found that the best way to propagate this information or to make it more enticing was to involve the U.S. in there. So in a way, yes, I think that in many respects, algorithms and machines are reshaping our information.
That's certainly true about climate videos. I was posting them on YouTube for a year or so, putting interviews out there. And what I found is that the YouTube algorithm has discovered that they get way more hits on people who deny climate change and that it's more interesting and it's some sort of reaction. And so they want the advertisers, they want the eyeballs. So somebody like Alex Jones, who's a climate denier, gets a lot more hits. And they were pushing that because they make money out of his billions of hits until they finally kicked him off the platform. I think, though, that when we dig into this further, and I hope that there will be more studies done on this, that we will find emotion is a key to social media changes in us. Advertisers already know this from studies and field trials. They worked out how to bypass that slow, rational decision-making part of the brain to get quickly and directly to our more primitive parts of the brain where emotions can trigger a reaction, and hopefully that'll be to buy something or support their political party. But after we watch 1,000 disasters and baby pictures, I wonder, do our emotions become overdrawn? Maybe we risk becoming emotionally flat in the real world when the mesmerizing screen lets go or when the power goes out. Have you seen any signs of this? Do you have thoughts on that?
Maybe one thing I wanted to mention, now you just touched an interesting point, which is there is this great book by Daniel Kahneman. He basically created the field of behavioral economics and won the Nobel Prize for it. And he has this book called Thinking Fast and Slow. It's very famous. I'm pretty sure many listeners will have read it. He basically describes this, that we think in two modes. So, and I think coming back to what you said about advertisers bypassing our rational mind, right? So he describes it as system one, which is this quick, it's basically, you know, or automatic reflexes to the environment, right? The brain is lazy, so it tries to make quick decisions with the least amount of processing, basically. And it will give a very quick decision, or this can be things like, you know, scanning your environment or things that go unnoticed by our conscious mind, or most of them. And then system two will be the type of deep thinking that gets activated if I tell you, okay, what is the answer to, I don't know, 728 times 115, right? If you start to activate your machinery there, you're in system two. So I think it's not only advertisers that have figured out that it's better to tackle system one, you know, when the gates are open, so to speak. I think coming back to this TikTok, you know, what happens when you're scrolling, you're scrolling on system one, right? You're just inhaling that information straight to your brain almost. Again, without having any thought process, just, you know, you're just swallowing that information without entirely on system one. I'm not sure about emotion. Again, I'm sure there is a case to be made about that. But for sure, you know, if we think about dopamine, and that's an interesting question. I think there's been a lot of research on dopamine and how the social media platforms target our dopamine receptors, right? But who knows? Maybe they target other neurochemicals, and that would, you know, basically neurochemicals at the end of the day are emotions. It's possible that we are becoming flatter, or even going back to this idea that, okay, I see something, you know, remotely, I don't know, disgusting or disheartening, you know, something bad has happened or something boring, and I just take out my phone and start scrolling. I think there we are basically becoming emotionally flat, right? At the slightest discomfort, I just resort to my dopamine.
Adam Kinzinger suggests TikTok is a weapon and, quote, the best weapon is one you don't know exists, or worse, one you think you can't live without. Do you think TikTok is a weapon?
Right, that's a very interesting quote. So I don't think TikTok is a weapon if we think of a weapon as having been engineered and, I don't know, the Chinese government has really put a lot of thought into creating this app and then has sent it to the U.S. or, you know, if we start to get a bit more into conspiracy theories. So I don't think it's a weapon in the sense that it has been designed from the ground up to be a weapon. But I do agree, or I would say that it is a danger, and maybe the biggest danger or is the one that you don't know exists, right? And I think the problem with TikTok or social media for that matter, is that we always think of, oh, AI overtaking the world by, you know, some form of mischievous consciousness, right? Like Skynet in Terminator. But I think the problem is that if what I say is true, right, if everyone is becoming more and more or dumber and dumber, and this is going unnoticed, there lies a real danger, right? That we may never wake up to the fact that we're in front of a danger, but we don't even know it exists.
So are you more worried about Chinese government subtly changing our minds or about direct deterioration of general brain power to become sort of a thoughtless herd?
Right, yeah, I would say it's more the second, your latter thought, right? It's more, again, I don't think this has been engineered or that there is some, you know, propaganda behind this. I think it's simply highly addictive, or it has happened to be highly addictive. Or maybe was thought to be highly addictive, but not in order to damage a certain, you know, population, or just the same way Instagram wants to be highly addictive and YouTube wants to be highly addictive, right? They compete for your attention and they want to be as addictive as possible. So I think that the real danger lies in everyone becoming a thoughtless herd. And again, going back to this idea of using the TV or social media to escape, there lies the danger, right? And maybe our governments. Well, yeah, our governments might start to make changes that, I don't know, we don't like, or we just have lost our capacity to think critically or to challenge the government. Well, because it doesn't matter, because we can just resort to social media and to scroll. So why would we care about whatever change is going on? So, and we may lose our capacity to think critically. And I think more than ever, you know, critical thought is becoming more and more important, right? We have all this we're flooded with information, and almost one of the key skills to survive our time is to be able to discern what is true and what is false and what is good and what is bad.
And you began by saying time and deep reflection are needed to produce worthwhile meaning. Your own TikTokification posts 1 and 2 were spread over a couple of years. Is part 3 coming out? And where are you going on this in light of DeepSeek and ChatGPT and all that?
I will certainly write a part 3, or at least it's been on my mind for a long time. It's just the more boring part, which is thinking about solutions, right? Or I think it's very hard to think exactly what the solution is. But I've come up with something, and in light of AI, you know, and all the dangers it can pose to our civilization, I've come up with something that I call the extrapolation rule, which is whenever you're designing an AI, and this can be, you know, it can range from detecting wildfires, from satellite imagery, to, I don't know, detecting breast cancer, to, again, hook us on the screen. Okay, what would happen if this AI were to become as good as possible? So let's say it would have a 100% success rate in detecting wildfires, right? As I train this algorithm, it will get better over time. So then the exercise is to think, okay, what will happen if the algorithm is perfect, and what will happen if everyone has it, okay? And if you think of AI in terms of detecting wildfires, so, well, if the AI is perfect at detecting wildfires, and let's say everyone can have, I don't know, this technology on their phones, or maybe this in this context doesn't make much sense, but, you know, the point is that if everyone could use this technology, what would happen? And in the case of detecting wildfires, we can see it would be pretty harmless, right? Or detecting breast cancer. Well, if everyone can detect breast cancer from their homes, that's great news. But now think of, for instance, the algorithm that's behind your feed. If it's perfect, I don't know if you've read a book called Infinite Jest, Alex.
No, I have not.
Okay, well, one of the premises of the book is that there is this movie that is so addictive that everyone that has watched the movie, they lose all interest for real life. The movie is so addictive that all they want to do is to watch it over and over again, to the point where they, you know, they will die of hunger or they basically lose all or forget to do all bodily functions, right? Because the movie is so addictive. So does this sound familiar? Well, if you think of these algorithms that are serving as this content and they would reach their maximum capacity, so to speak, then we would just be scrolling forever, right? If this content is so enticing, then we would just be scrolling forever. And then what would happen if I give this, if this algorithm is in every phone, well, then, you know, we lose society. So that's the extrapolation rule, right? You're developing an AI algorithm. What will happen if it's perfect? And what will happen if everyone has it? And, you know, to give another example, you've probably heard of deep fakes, right? These are these highly realistic videos. And now you can fake things like Obama talking. I think there was even a video of the Russian government faking president of Ukraine, saying that Ukraine was surrendering. So you can immediately see that if this technology were to become better and better and everyone could create these fake videos, well, I think that would pose an extreme danger to everyone. So that's the idea that I'm exploring. So the idea of the third pause would be to think of solutions. And I think this is one of the things I want to discuss, which is, okay, what guidelines can we think of when we develop AI algorithms?
How would the guidelines work? I mean, would some sort of government say to TikTok, well, you must allow, you know, we'll have to think about what those solutions would be and how they would be implemented. And there may be a reaction from a bunch of people saying, no, no, I've quit TikTok. It's I've gone back to real life. We can hope that that will happen. We've been speaking with a scientist who now writes at the site Medium under his pen name, The White Orange. You can find links to his work and my own lengthy rant about all this, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Mr. Orange, thank you for sharing your brain with us while we still can.
Well, thank you so much, Alex. Hope that was fruitful.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.